Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and today's article is The Christian Web Designer Case Could Have Been Much Easier. On the last day of its recent term, the Supreme Court decided the case of 303 Creative versus Alanis. In my view, the court's disposition was correct, but it was rendered more difficult by confusion over the Constitution's First Amendment and how it uses the terms the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. As explained below, 303 Creative should have been treated as a press case, not as a speech case. If it had been so treated, the discussion of 303 Creative's commercial nature would have been unnecessary. Lori Smith owns 303 Creative, a Colorado company that sells custom designs for websites. Most listeners probably know 303 was Colorado's original telephone area code. Ms. Smith wanted to expand her business into designing wedding sites. However, she's a Christian, and she holds the view traditional among Christians, Jews, and Muslims that same-sex marriages violate God's law. Ms. Smith knew that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had been very aggressive in enforcing its version of the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act against others of her faith. Readers may recall the Supreme Court's 2018 decision in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, where the court chastised the Colorado Civil Rights Commission for its anti-religious bias. As a resident of Colorado, I'm dismayed at the authoritarian turn this formerly libertarian state has taken on a wide range of issues. By way of illustration, in 303 Creative, both the Court of Appeals, which ruled for the state, and the majority opinion by Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was also a Coloradan, flagged the state's official policy in this area. Colorado's policy apparently is to crush all dissent from people like Smith. Quote, "The Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act's purpose and history," Gorsuch wrote, "also demonstrates how the statute is a content-based restriction. Eliminating such ideas is the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act's very purpose." Moreover, as Gorsuch noted more obliquely, Colorado has expanded its expression suppression mission far beyond traditional civil rights categories. The Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act now privileges certain voluntary behaviors that were previously seen by most people as antisocial, including so-called gender expression and outre or wild hairstyles. Much of the dispute in 303 Creative centered on the commercial nature of Ms. Smith's activity. The state argued, as paraphrased by Justice Gorsuch, that, quote, "This case involves only the sale of an ordinary commercial product," says the state, "and any burden on Ms. Smith's speech is purely incidental." Similarly, Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissent emphasized 303 Creative's commercial nature. She distinguished earlier rulings in favor of free speech by noting that the prior cases had involved rights of nonprofit expressive associations. However, the court held that the commercial nature of the firm was not dispositive because, quote, "Ms. Smith does not seek to sell an ordinary commercial good, but intends to create customized and tailored speech for each couple." Current free speech jurisdiction is mostly a product of the court's 20th century First Amendment decisions. Those decisions relied very little on how the founders understood the amendment's terms. Instead, 20th century Supreme Court justices seem to have relied more on instinct or gut reaction and their own recent precedents. Where the First Amendment is concerned, that practice continues among most of the current justices, as exemplified by this past term's decision in another free speech case called Counterman versus Colorado. Unfortunately, the lack of connection between modern jurisprudence and the original meaning of the First Amendment creates serious problems. I've written previously of the unnecessary confusion in the cases involving anonymity and donor privacy. As explained below, another product of this lack of connection between modern jurisprudence and original meaning is the varying levels of protection afforded commercial and non-commercial writings. Of course, members of the founding generation were unfamiliar with electronic broadcasting, things like radio, television, and the internet. But members of the founding generation were very familiar with the important distinction between speaking directly or, on the other hand, speaking through a medium. During the founding era, freedom of speech invariably referred to in-person communication. Protection for freedom of speech applied in legislative assemblies, other assemblies, in speeches and orations, and in verbal discourse between individuals. By contrast, the law of freedom of the press, which people in the founding generation very commonly called liberty of the press, this law protected communication through media. The nature of the medium didn't matter. It could be a newspaper, an op-ed article, a letter to the editor, a written circular, or it could be a poster, what they called a broadside, or a sign, a leaflet, a book, or a pamphlet. The law of press freedom protected the publisher, editor, distributor, and author. There were recognized legal limitations on both freedom of speech and of the press. However, the limitations applicable to one did not necessarily apply to the other. This was because of differences between speaking directly and speaking through a medium. For example, one's anonymity was protected when one spoke through a medium, but not when one spoke directly. Additionally, it was more difficult to recover damages for spoken slander than for printed libel. The reason was explained this way. A defamatory statement made in person dissipated into air, but a defamatory statement communicated by a medium was preserved, often resulting in dissemination across distances of space and time, and of course, enormous damage for the person who was libeled. Despite technological advance, these differences remain relevant today. An in-person insult is heard only by those present and is not preserved in permanent form. But defamation on a website, a written advertisement, or even a radio interview may be preserved indefinitely and be seen or heard by millions of people. At one point, Justice Gorsuch, in his opinion for the court, seemed to acknowledge the continuity of principle. Quote, 100 years ago, he said, Ms. Smith might have furnished her services using pen and paper, end quote. Well, that's right. But unfortunately, he did not recognize the implications of this comment. What he said after that was, those services are no less protected speech today because they are conveyed with a voice that resonates farther than it could from any soapbox. Now, what he should have added instead was that those services were and are protected as freedom of the press because, since they're communicated through a medium, they're conveyed with a voice that resonates farther than it could from any soapbox. During the founding era, freedom of speech was understood to protect for-profit activities and communications, as well as any other activities and communications. After all, most newspapers were for-profit businesses. The protection extended to commercial messages. As Thomas Bradbury Chandler, who was a prominent American clergyman, wrote in 1775, quote, a free press is the channel of communication as to mercantile and public affairs. Notice he said mercantile affairs before he said public. A March 28, 1788 article in a New Hampshire newspaper described the value of newspapers largely by referring to their business content. And here's the business part of the quote. In newspapers, we find many interesting thoughts in agriculture and commerce. The merchant learns the general state of trade. Here's the prices current. Thus, he and the insurer are mutually advantaged. The artist hears of employment or presents an advertisement of the various things he has for sale. The First Continental Congress also officially emphasized the very broad sweep of liberty of the press, far, far beyond politics. in its official letter to the inhabitants of the province of Quebec, written in 1774. Indeed, in 3 decades of founding era study, I have never come across any suggestion that commercial communication was entitled to less protection than other forms of expression. Once we understand that Ms. Smith was exercising freedom of the press rather than freedom of speech, the for-profit status of her firm becomes irrelevant. Even today, we know that government may not compel a for-profit newspaper to publish unwelcome content, for example. The Supreme Court so held in the 1974 case of Miami Herald versus Tornillo. By parity of reasoning, government may not compel Ms. Smith to create websites for same-sex weddings or for any other kind of wedding she may object to. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.